Hundreds of people join a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid farewell to a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack. Thousands of people hold rallies in France to voice concerns about the rise of racist far-right groups. We'll have a report. And the Israeli parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end the 12-year rule of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. World News, live from Tehran. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Hundreds of people have joined a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid farewell to a Muslim family that was killed in a hate-motivated attack. The mourners paid tribute to the four victims as they gathered at the city's Islamic Center. They held a procession before laying the victims' bodies to rest. The ceremony was aired live on major Canadian networks. The family members were deliberately run over by a pickup truck driver last Sunday as they were out for a walk. The attack sparked outrage across Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau calling it a terrorist act. The incident was the worst against Canadian Muslims since 2017, when a gunman killed six worshippers at a mosque in Quebec. Political analyst and commentator Jason Ruha says that hate-motivated attacks are on the rise due to a demographic change in Canada.
We definitely have seen an increase. I think there's definitely a trend here. This is becoming increasingly more common. This has been something that has been building for some time. As the demographics switch in Canada due to immigration, there's going to be this kind of resentment, this perceived replacement. There has been fundamental shifts within the Conservative Party of Canada, who have used to be called the Progressive Conservative Party, but are now the Conservative Party. And they've been taking many harder right-wing stances, anti-immigration, anti-pro-choice, a lot of these very scary Americanish type of policies. It's quite frightening when we look at it.
In France, marches have been held against the rise of a racist far-right and in defense of liberties. Protesters fear the impunity of Islamophobic and racist militia, and they're asking the French government to take popular measures instead of copying far-right topics. Kristen Hoon has a report from Paris.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far-right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with their threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
As the G7 summit reaches its climax in Cornwall, a day of rage and action for Palestine is underway to condemn world leaders for their lack of action in protecting Palestinians from Israeli aggression. Protests took place up and down the UK, but in London, thousands mobilized outside Downing Street demanding change. Robert Carter was also there.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
International lawyer John Philpott believes that Western leaders who have committed crimes against Palestinian people should be brought to justice.
People have to understand that if you sell arms that are going to be used to kill people in an occupation, because it's an occupation, right? Gaza is a concentration camp. They have the right to shoot at those who occupy them and keep them in prison. But if people, and the U.S. is selling apparently better arms because their arms, the arms that Israel had were not as accurate. So those who sell the arms are liable. If I sell a gun to my neighbor who goes and robs a bank, I am accomplice to that crime. And that applies to the U.S. leaders. It probably applies to Britain. And Canada sells arms to Israel, and Britain does. And it's not the ICC. I wouldn't want to emphasize the zeal of the ICC, but they are liable. The leaders who committed the crimes must be held liable, both criminally and civilly. In the sense, they must repair the damages. They must provide reparation.
Thousands of Israelis have protested outside Prime Minister Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem Al-Quds. The protests came on the eve of a crucial vote in parliament that could end the reign of the regime's longest-serving prime minister. Protesters have staged rallies on an almost weekly basis since last July to denounce Netanyahu's handling of COVID-19 and the economy. Sentiments against Netanyahu have been deepened by his indictment while being in office. He's accused of accepting improper gifts and trying to trade regulatory favors with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage. The Israeli parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end the 12-year rule of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The Knesset vote will either see a fragile 8-party alliance to power or return Israel to a stalemate and possibly a fifth general election since 2019. The new coalition consists of parties ranging from the right-wing Yamina to Arab lawmakers. It's already selected centrist politician Yair Lapid and ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett to serve as premier for 2 years each. After Netanyahu's failure to form a cabinet following an inconclusive March election, Lapid was tasked with forming a coalition. Netanyahu is already facing a host of corruption charges, and also Israelis holding protests against his handle of COVID-19 and the economy. Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian woman at a military checkpoint north of Jerusalem al-Quds. They allege that the woman had planned to carry out a stabbing attack at the Qalandiyah checkpoint. Her brother said that she died of her wounds after being left lying on the ground. Palestinian officials identified the victim as 27-year-old Ibtissam Kabna. She had been detained and sentenced to 18 months in prison in 2016. The Islamic Jihad movement has condemned the killing as the ugliest form of terrorism. The Gaza-based resistance movement also criticized the international community's silence on Israel's atrocities. This comes a day after Israeli forces shot dead a 15-year-old Palestinian near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendall says the Palestinians shot dead over the past week were killed in cold blood as they posed no possible threat to the Israeli forces.
Well, the Israeli police issued a statement saying that a Palestinian woman arrived at the Qalandiyah military checkpoint to the south of Ramallah near Jerusalem al-Quds, and that she had a knife. The Israeli soldiers opened fire at her, shot her, and left her on the ground bleeding. They didn't even rescue her. We have to mention that many Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood, mainly at Israeli military checkpoints on mere suspicions. And later, it was discovered or revealed that none of those Palestinians who were killed on cold blood have posed any threat to the Israeli soldiers. If the Israelis were, their story was right, or their claims were right, then why they didn't post any videos for this Palestinian woman? However, a video posted online showed Ibtissam Kaabni on the ground lying with Israeli soldiers around her. This is the story of the Israeli police.
At least 18 people have been killed and several more wounded in 2 artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. The first attack reportedly hit a residential area, and the second one targeted a hospital shortly afterward. A local Turkish official cited hospital sources saying that a Kurdish YPG militant hit the building with a missile. The official said the Turkish artillery units shelled rural positions near the city of Ma'aret al-Numan in response. Ankara views the U.S.-backed YPG as a terrorist organization. In 2019, Turkey launched a cross-border operation in neighboring Syria under the pretext of pushing YPG-affiliated forces away from its borders. Tehran says there are still numerous technical, legal, and political discussions that need to be made before attempts to revive the nuclear deal can bear any fruit. Top nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi says that Tehran is seeking assurances that Washington won't withdraw from the deal again. Umalesky reports.
Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the U.S. back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principle character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homar Izgi, Vienna.
Political commentator Scott Bennett says that there is no guarantee that U.S. administrations would remain committed to the deals reached by their predecessors.
A presidential administration can change, moment by moment, day by day, any and all agreements and any and all treaties and such that are entered into. So there's really no firm reliance or absolute dependability on an American presidential administration and these promises. However, if I was advising the Iranians, I would say the best way to guarantee and ensure that the United States government and the presidential administration commits to and fulfills and honors all of the elements and promises of the JCPOA is to make it absolutely attractive and a deal that the American people themselves could not turn down. And that's really the target of all negotiation and diplomatic communications and public relations and persuasion operations should be towards the American people, not the government, not the military-industrial complex, not the Zionists in Congress or the Mossad-friendly puppets who have been extorted.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who is talking the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam, dear listeners, warmest greetings to you, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, June 13th, 2021. I'm Atef Erfani hosting this program today. As you know, Listeners Special is a Sunday program where your views are presented through emails and letters or messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us your views about our programs. Or if you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Keep us company until the end of the program. Hello again. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. Yes, these reception reports are very useful and important to us in IRIB English Radio, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our dear listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. Yes, these days we send you EQSL cards. And here, I do appreciate those of our dear listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh. Hello, Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, and thank you very much for sending us reception reports. Yes, Mizanur Rahman is one of our regular listeners. And another regular listener from Latvia, Andrew Kuznetsov, has sent us a reception report. And also Fakri from Indonesia has sent us a reception report. And here I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us emails and letters from around the world, which I mention some of their names here, and later during the program I will read their emails or letters, including Shailesh Vaid from India has sent us an email, Sergey M. Izumov from Russia, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email, Murthy from India has sent us an email, and from England we have an email from Patrick Traverse. Patrick is also one of our regular listeners. Muhammad Sharifal Islam from Bangladesh, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email, and so many other emails which, because of the time, I can't read their names, but in upcoming programs of Listeners Special I will read their emails or letters. For the time being, stay with us, please. After a short break, I will be back with all these kind emails and letters. Stay tuned. Welcome welcome back. Here we have an email from India. This email is from one of our listeners, Murti. Murti from India says, as a regular World Service listener for many years, I am happy to tell you that during those years, I have learned so much about your beautiful country. There have been many changes in different areas in your country, such as economic, social, and tourism fields, which people of your country will benefit from. I have reasons to stay a regular listener of your English broadcast, but the most important reason is quality of good English programs. I should say that your radio is my favorite worldwide broadcasting service, so I would like to put my World Radio Club address on your mailing list for your programs. Thank you, and we are waiting to hear about you very soon. Please convey my best wishes to staff of IRIB English Service. First of all, salam and warmest greetings to you, Moti from India, and deepest thanks to you for sending us this really encouraging and inspiring message to staff of IRIB English Radio. Your views on IRIB English Radio programs were very inspiring, and it seems that you've already joined IRIB English Radio, and this message really shows your commitment, your love, and your kindness toward IRIB English Radio. It's really amazing that you learned so much about Iran through our radio. It's great. So in your upcoming emails or letters, please tell us what exactly you've learned from IRIB English Radio. As you said, you've learned a lot about Iran through our radio. It's great. It's an honor. And it's also really wonderful to know that you have found reasons to stay committed to our radio, including, as you said, the quality of the programs. Thank you. Thank you so much for your compliments, Murti from India. We are so honored to have you with us as a loyal and regular listener of IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. Yes, we in Iran and in IRIB English Radio, we wish you all the best. Please keep in touch with us. We will send you very soon an EQSL card. Let this relationship continue. Murti from India, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast. And here we have a message from Russia. This message, this email actually, is from Sergei M. Izumov. Sergei is one of our regular listeners who says, it would be great if you send me out your frequency list. Also, please send me your beautiful postcards representing different corners of Iran and other promotional items if possible. Salam, Sergei M. Izumov from Russia, and thanks a lot for sending us this message. You're a regular listener of IRIB English Radio, and you must know that, you know, we have the frequency schedule. We have this schedule on our website. Yes, you can find the frequency list on our website at www.parstoday.com/EN. Yes, again, www.parstoday.com/EN. Yes, you can find the frequency list, the frequency schedule of our broadcast there. And my colleagues will send you very soon an EQSL card, as well as the promotional items of IRIB English Radio, if available and if possible. Sergei M. Izumov from Russia, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Thank you very much. Well, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Please stay with us. Well, you just heard a piece of Iranian traditional music, and I really enjoyed it. From India, we have an email from Shailesh Wait from India. Shailesh, he or she says, I happened to hear your program on global warming a few days ago. The reception was quite clear. I really enjoyed listening to this informative program. I especially found very interesting how global warming is affecting our lives as human beings in a negative way. I thank you for producing such quality programs, and I would look forward to listen to many such programs on your radio station in the future. First of all, salam, Shailesh Wait from India, and warmest greetings to you. Many thanks for sending us this email. So, you had the chance to catch a program on global warming. I guess it was a program in the limelight. Yes, we have a program called In the Limelight, and I think you catch the program about global warming in this program, In the Limelight. We have had such programs on this subject in this program, In the Limelight, and we're so glad that you found this program very informative. Thank you very much, and we're so glad that you found our broadcast very informative and interesting. Anyway, wish you all the best. Shailesh Wait from India, write to us soon. Keep in touch with us and tell us your views about other programs of IRIB English Radio, because this helps us to make better and the high quality of the programs in IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much, Shailesh Wait from India. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And here we have an email from Bangladesh. This email is from Muhammad Shariful Islam. Muhammad Shariful Islam is one of our regular listeners who says, thank you for being in touch with us. This is to inform you that I am always listening to IRIB English Radio every now and then, and I have some reception reports of past month with some comments which I shall send in the coming days when I manage to find some time. Thank you in advance. Wishing you health and well-being during this pandemic. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Muhammad Shariful Islam from Bangladesh, and warmest and deepest thanks to you for sending us this email. Muhammad Shariful Islam is one of our regular listeners. Thank you very much for sending us this email. And it's great. So you prefer listening to IRIB English Radio. As you said, you every now and then listen to this program. You said you always listen to this program and every now and then have the reception reports of the past month. Thank you very much. We also wish you the best, especially wish you the best quality of the health and life and well-being during this pandemic. And we wish this pandemic, be eradicated throughout the world very soon. Thank you very much, Muhammad Shariful Islam from Bangladesh. Write to us soon. Well, dear listeners, after a short break, we will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back from England, from Patrick Traverse from England, one of our regular listeners. We have an email. This email says, Dear friends, I found listening to your English broadcast this evening very interesting and enjoyable. I would be very interested in learning more about your broadcast, and I would welcome any information. Please, will you send a program schedule and pennant or any other publicity manual? First of all, hello, salam, Patrick Travers from England, and thank you very much for sending us this email. So you found listening to our English broadcast this evening, in your time, of course, in time of writing this email, very interesting and enjoyable. Okay, why don't you tell us the name of that program? Yes, tell us your views about our broadcast. Boy, your views, you dear listeners, you know, your views help us make better and better programs in the future. Yes, tell us your views about our broadcast. And you said that you are interested in learning more about our broadcast and welcome any information. Yes, you can find any information about IRAB English Radio and the archive of our program in our website at www.parsley.com/en. You can find the program schedule, the time of our programs, and also the archive of our program. Also, the online broadcast of our radio, IRAB English Radio, is available also in our website. If your shortwave radio is not available at the time you want to listen to our radio. And my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. And the promotional items and the pennant you've requested will be sent to you as soon as possible, if possible and available. Anyway, Patrick Travers from England, thank you very much for sending us this email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our broadcast. The listeners, here we reach to the section of this week's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. Please take a listen.
My name is Chris Dampier. I'm retired. I'm coming up to 75 years old, and I live in Hertfordshire. That's about 30 miles north. Sydney's in Hertfordshire, 30 miles north of London. And I've been a shortwave listener now for about 60-odd years. Overall, I find the programs of RRB very interesting, obviously complete opposite to what we're learning in the media in Great Britain. This is obviously, again, it's a political situation in your country, but obviously it gives the enlightenment of your view of your side and particularly your part of the world as to what's going on. Particularly some of the news in the Middle East is not covered here in our local media. In fact, in the last week, the local media has been just obsessed with Brexit and Mr. Boris Johnson, and anything else that's happened on the international scene has really pretty well been ignored. A message to our listeners is obviously keep listening to IRIB, because obviously you're providing a very good service in giving an opposite view of what a lot of the media are saying in another part of the world. And I think this is important. Otherwise, not everyone gets one point of view and there's nothing outstanding on the other side. And possibly the other side is right. And this has quite often happened before.
And wishing you all the best in your health and in your life, we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, the Sunday program. Please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio, and goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to English Radio at irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RIB English Radio.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, June 16th is when a Russian-U.S. summit will be held in Switzerland. Usually when these types of meetings are held between countries, there's hope of closer and better relations, but that does not seem to be the case with these two countries, whose relations have been on a downward path for a while now and have even accelerated in its decline with the election of Joe Biden as U.S. president. Stay with us as we take a look at what the summit could bring and what it all could mean on this debate. I'd like to start this all off, crossing over to Washington, D.C., welcoming Colin Campbell. Colin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, tell us what's being said about this summit from that side of the world.
Right now, Marcia, as you know, the rating between the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is believed to be one of the worst it has been in years, and especially when you have the American president that is visiting right now in Cornwall for the G7, where Russia has been excluded from what used to be the D8, you can tell that there is some tension between Russia and the U.S. Well, with the upcoming meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, there's expected to be a myriad of issues that they will be addressing. One of the big things is cybersecurity, where there were reported to be a number of breaches on behalf of the Russians into U.S. agencies and U.S. banking systems and the U.S. cyberstructure in general. And of course, you have the annexation of Crimea, which has been a long sore subject for the U.S. and U.S. officials. And then you have other issues like climate change. One thing that we have to remember is right now, with this president, with Joe Biden, the U.S., or at least the Biden administration at the very least, is viewing Russia, including China, as a threat, as an adversary, which is much different than the tone that the previous president had with Vladimir Putin, where there seemed to be some type of camaraderie. Some have even described it as a romance between brothers. This is not going to be the case with Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, where the relationship already seems to be adversarial. So there are going to be a myriad issues. They're going to have to get past their relationship difficulties and then see how both countries could move forward with some type of amenable relationship.
Thanks so much for that update. That's Press TV's Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. And now I'd like to welcome our guests out of New York, Don DeBar, radio host, journalist, and political activist. Don, great to see you. Don, do you think that this upcoming summit will be as tumultuous as the China-U.S. talks, which we saw earlier this year?
Well, it's a good thing to reference the way the United States' policy is tilted some vis-a-vis China in the context of looking at relations with Russia. You know, 50 years ago, when Kissinger goes to China and Nixon goes to China, and you essentially have a breaking up of the socialist bloc into a three-headed monster in the world, with the United States and the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China as three points on a triangle, instead of having a trilateral relationship, with the United States pitting one against the other. U.S. policy since December of 1991, you remember that Hillary Clinton said Christmas in the Kremlin, it's kind of like Christmas 1991, the Soviet Union falls, and U.S. policy, rather than acknowledging that, gee, we always wanted them to have a capitalist economic system, and to be willing to take, you know, let us buy chunks of their industry and all this stuff, that they would have accepted victory and that's it. But instead, the U.S. kept moving its military resources right up to, in essence, occupying some of the same territory that Hitler occupied in Operation Barbarossa. The Baltic republics are now part of NATO. Ukraine is, for all practical purposes, part of NATO. The entire Warsaw Pact, I believe, is part of NATO. And so the strategic position towards the former Soviet Union, towards Russia, has actually been more aggressive on a steady pace since 1991. China also has seen a U.S. aggressive posture, particularly from the period of the Obama administration, with the whole roiling over the South China Sea, some very aggressive naval maneuvering that goes on there on a regular basis, provocative patrols, also the insertion of THAAD missiles into Korea. Just now, as a matter of fact, Biden telling the Republic of Korea, in other words, South Korea, it's okay if you build your own missiles that can reach Beijing. Now, the message being received in both Beijing and Moscow is, in essence, the U.S. is an existential threat. We saw in 2014, after the coup in Ukraine, that the response was then they stood up and declared that they have a strategic partnership, which is the exact undoing, almost the antithesis, of what they were trying to achieve in the late 60s and actually had achieved to the benefit of the United States. It's hard to understand what the strategy is other than it looking like they're going to go to war with both of them, which is insane.
Well, stay with me, Don, because I want to look at that a little bit later. But let me get our next guests in on this discussion. Bill Jones out of Leesburg from the Executive Intelligence Review. Thanks so much for being with us, Bill. Now, as Don just talking about the increased antagonism between the U.S. and Russia, also the U.S. and China, why do you think that is the case? Why has Washington chosen to go in that direction?
Well, in principle, it's the fact that the international system as we have known it since the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the United States being the rule maker, is at an end. It's falling apart financially, economically, and in every possible way. What has happened over the last decade is that, of course, Russia, which was more or less on its last legs by the beginning of the 1990s, as I think the speaker might have mentioned, came back under President Putin. China had this remarkably dramatic development, which it has now become the second most important economic power in the world and probably the motor, the real engine of economic development at this point. The United States, through its own mistakes, through its own negligence, through its own neglect, let its economy really go to hell in a handbasket. The big profits were in the developing countries, where you paid a dollar a day for workers, so that our industries were left adrift. Our workers were sent from factories, high-tech factories, to McDonald's, and the U.S. economy was in very sad shape, and it's only the power of the dollar which gave an indication that it was still on top of the game. But with the rise of China, this suddenly changed. The Belt and Road Initiative changed the geometry for the developing world in Africa, Asia, Latin America. All these countries were going to hell in a handbasket as a result of Western financial policy and total neglect. With the BRI, they started moving forward. So instead of reacting positively to this, looking at what's going on and saying, hey, we better put our game together and try and invest and do the kind of things that China is doing that we used to do. Instead, they have said they are going to undermine this program and to try and reassert the world as it was 10 years before.
Okay.
The G7 meeting was an example of that, but I think it is doomed to failure.
Well, Don, I mean, both you and Bill have now talked about the direction that the United States could have gone and should have gone, but chose to go in a more antagonistic way. Going back to 1991, of course, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and we saw this rise in that capitalist perspective taking place in the former Soviet Union, in Russia. And you mentioned that. Why do you think that the United States was not satisfied with that, saying, okay, that we've won, the capitalist perspective in this case has won, and worked together as allies, but instead, as you mentioned, we saw a lot more aggression as far as NATO and taking over or controlling some of those former Soviet states. Why do you think that Washington took that path?
Clearly, the interests of a very small group of people who have control of the levers of power in the West, it's, you know, it's not a question really, it's a statement of fact. Their policy was not intended to bring capitalism and democracy to the people of Russia and to thwart the quote-unquote Red Menace. Rather, it was to protect their own interests from, you know, a spread basically of socialist ideas and economics, and particularly the forward movement of their own greed, basically, that not only do we want capitalist relations in Russia, we want to own everything ourselves. Me, I want it. I don't want them to have it that way. I want it. And the positioning of U.S. forces is intended to do exactly that. The demands that are made on Russia, for example, have nothing to do with any restoration of socialism in the country, although the undoing of some of the looting that went on by some Western interests certainly roiled a few feathers here. But more importantly, what's been happening is the people here that make the decisions have been looking at the geostrategic position vis-a-vis Russia constantly and pursuing, you know, an adverse relationship in that area since 1991, even more aggressively. It was enough when they had Boris Yeltsin in there pretty much as an affable puppet when he wasn't blowing up the parliament. But when there was just a thwarting of the continued looting of the country and an ultimate takeover of Rosneft and the other petrochemical and oil industries by Western corporations, when they were thwarted in that, they started turning up the heat, and instead of pretending to be nice while they moved the army and the tanks and stuff into position at the borders, they started getting nasty. Finally, when Donald Trump got elected and started questioning that entire paradigm, started saying, well, you know, we don't have to be belligerent towards Russia, and, you know, we don't need NATO, this military monster anymore that costs us so much money because the Soviet Union is gone and its purpose was to protect us from that. The reason that he became the heretic that the intel agencies, the media, and the entire power elite in both parties turned on him was over exactly that question. There are some very powerful people that think that the wealth of Russia and its people belongs to them. They have the largest military in the history of the world that's been working on that project since 1917, really, and in China since 1949, and they're trying to achieve it. They're trying to actualize this, and they're risking world war over it.
Hmm. What about that, Bill? Are we talking about the 1%, the elitists, doing all of this just for their own sake? As Don has just said, even risking war and costing people across the world and even the Americans themselves a whole lot of money and increasing tension for basically what they would see as a profit for a few.
Well, the question facing the United States is it prepared to work together with other major powers, and I include among these major powers Russia and China, to try and rebuild a financial and world economic system that works for the people's benefits. What China has shown is that the world can move in a different direction. They can move to eliminate poverty. They can move to begin a program of rapid development, even in the most desolated countries in Africa and Asia, to try and bring them up to a modern standard. And the technical means are there now. They've been there for a long time. And now the political will has been shown by China in moving in that direction. But is the United States willing to work with China on this, or is it prepared to maintain and to reassert, I should say, its hegemony by undermining China's economic development? Right now, it seems that they're moving in that direction, although I think there's a little bit of doubt as to whether they're going to accomplish this, given some of the statements coming out from the White House just recently, both with regard to Russia and with regard to the discussions with China. But if they moved in that direction, this would become an existential threat for both China and Russia. And since it would be an existential threat to undermine their own economic development, I think that that could very easily lead to war, as the other speaker clearly indicated. I think, however, that if this goes too far, where it shows that the tensions are going to reach a breaking point, I think the President administration will have to change tack and move in a direction of trying to find a means of working together with these so-called rivals in order to deal with some of the fundamental questions facing the world, like the economic crisis, like the financial blowout that we're facing today. But it's anybody's guess if they will be wise enough to do that, and the present direction that it's taking is a very, very dangerous direction.
Well, Don, what about that? You heard what Bill said. Do you see the United States changing direction and being able to work with Russia, with China? Or do you anticipate this continual decline in relations between Washington, Beijing, and Moscow?
First of all, I hope he's right in the last part of Bill's statement that they're going to be forced to change course. The problem is that the very essence of their behavior rests on an irrational set of conditions. And by that I mean in terms of economics. I had a conversation with the guy who was the acting head of the Export-Import Bank a couple of years ago down in Washington on this particular point. And that is, the United States has, the world has, say, 7 billion people or whatever it is, and somewhere between a third to a half of them are challenged or lack completely water, sewage, housing, hospitals, electrical grid, all kinds of infrastructure, schools, et cetera, on the one hand. On the other hand, in the United States alone, the ability to build hospitals, schools, housing, et cetera, all these things, we have the expertise to do it. We have the equipment sitting on lots, rusting, in essence, masons and carpenters and all of that. And for some reason, the irrationality, the essential irrationality of the economic system here does not make it profitable, does not make it, successful. It can't really actualize applying these resources to those problems which they were designed to solve. On the other hand, China can go from place to place in the world and say, want this or you want that, and they can build canals, we can build deep water ports, we can build transcontinental railroads, we can put your satellites up in the air. Oh, and by the way, we can build you a city if you want one. And for some reason, their accounting system makes that a profit